US President Donald Trump appears to acknowledge for the first time that Joe Biden could succeed him after saying time will tell if he remains in the office. Iran says the US policy of maximum pressure and sanctions has failed and will only further lead to isolation of Washington on the international stage. Also coming up, the UN says Libya's warring sides have agreed to hold parliamentary and presidential elections in December next year. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story, U.S. President Donald Trump says time will tell which administration will take office in the White House in January.
Ideally, we won't go to a lockdown. I will not go. This administration will not be going to a lockdown. Hopefully, whatever happens in the future, who knows which administration it will be. I guess time will tell. But I can tell you this administration will not go to a lockdown.
The remarks are the first indication that Trump could concede defeat in the disputed November 3rd presidential election. The comments are also the first since U.S. media widely projected his Democratic rival Joe Biden as the winner of the disputed election. Trump has claimed widespread votes of fraud in key battleground states and has refused to concede defeat. Republicans have stood by him, but Democrats say Trump is only dividing the nation by refusing to accept Biden's victory. Romero Funes is the co-editor at Anticonquista, and he joins us now from Los Angeles. He's referring there to the lockdown. Did you see any indication that Trump, in his statements there, could concede defeat?
It's looking every day like Trump actually may be forced to step down. What it seems like is that there was an agreement within the ruling class of the United States that Trump needs to go. Trump has made it's too obvious that the United States wants global hegemony. Biden wants war. Biden wants to increase sanctions. Biden wants to expand U.S. presence. That's actually one of the critiques that Biden has of Trump. He said, quote, we're going to get back in the game, meaning that Biden's administration plans to be more hawkish, more aggressive towards countries like Iran, like Venezuela, like Nicaragua. And so what we're seeing is that the people who control both parties, the Democrats and Republicans, they want Trump out. You know, Trump is not perfect by any means. He's actually really bad for the American people. But the one thing that we can all give him credit is that he exposed the reality of the U.S. empire. He showed just how brutal it is. And I think for a lot of people on Wall Street and Washington who want to rebrand U.S. empire, Trump is too dangerous. And it's looking every day like Trump may be forced to concede. Another thing to really keep in mind is that Trump may face some criminal charges after he becomes president, once he steps down, and his presidential immunity may be the only thing saving him at the moment. And so it's looking every day like Trump is going to be forced out and the Biden-Harris administration is going to step in.
Interesting. I guess the other big major question is that if Trump were to transfer power peacefully, will his supporters, the hardcore supporters, follow suit?
A lot of Trump's right-wing base will not support the Kamala Harris and Joe Biden administration, his base. However, his top funders will definitely support Biden and Kamala, and they already are. For example, AIPAC, which the Zionist lobby in Washington, D.C., Wall Street, you know, even Netanyahu just the other day acknowledged Biden and Kamala, is saying he wants to work with them on attacking Iran. And so the Trump's base, which is a poor, we have to make a distinguishment between his base, which tends to be more rural, more working class people in the United States. They're not going to go for Biden and Kamala, but the people to really look out for who supported Trump, Sheldon Adelson, AIPAC, the Zionist lobby, Wall Street, they're already shifting their bets. They're already moving into supporting Biden and Harris. And that's what we're seeing, is that these top Wall Street executives, politicians are already recognizing Biden and Harris. And that's the real danger, is that
right,
now...
Indeed. And what about his voter base, not the the lobbyists or the hawkish lobbyists, as you are referring them to?
Donald Trump's base is definitely against Kamala Harris and Joe Biden. I mean, Donald Trump's base represents the lower and middle class business owners who have small businesses. Let's not forget that during this pandemic, a lot of businesses have been forced to shut down because of the stay-at-home orders, because of quarantine. And they're very upset that the Democrats have been pushing for the lockdowns. And so they're not going to vote for, they're not going to support Biden and Harris. And I think what we're going to see within the next few weeks and months is increased tension between this this right-wing populist base in the United States against the Democratic leadership in the country.
Romero, thank you very much indeed, as always, for your thoughts. Romero Funes, the co-editor of Anticonquista, joining us from Los Angeles. Now, supporters of U.S. President Donald Trump and projected election winner Joe Biden traded barbs outside the White House in the wake of the disputed November 3rd election. The two groups mingled as individual protesters traded barbs. The pro-Biden protesters carried signs calling for Trump and Vice President Mike Pence to leave the White House. They called the incumbent president a loser and denounced his presidency as a failure. They said Trump should respect democracy. Pro-Trump protesters faced them, accusing the Democrats of election fraud and stealing the vote. The rallies come ahead of a mass protest planned for Saturday by Trump supporters in the Democratic stronghold. Colin Campbell says police is going to shut down the downtown areas of Washington, D.C. amid growing tension between supporters of Donald Trump and Joe Biden.
They are growing by the minute, and they are expected to be a lot bigger on Saturday, and that's when the city, at least the downtown area, is going to be shut down. And of course, we're talking about the city of Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, where there are going to be rivaling protests going on. Those who celebrate the president and believe that he should be president, he should have won for re-election, that he's not the president-elect, but the person who should be going back into his second term, even though election results have shown the opposite. Now, these are groups like the Proud Boys and other factions that agree with the president, who have supported the president, who believe that, again, he won re-election. They call it the Million MAGA Rally, I believe. Now, this is a name taken from the Million Man March that Minister Louis Farrakhan had organized quite some time ago. Well, now they're calling it the Million MAGA March. And they're hoping to agglomerate all of these people on the White House to, I don't know if it's to really sway the election results, but possibly to put pressure on the president to dig in, since he hasn't yet conceded. Now, meanwhile, you have those just behind the White House and Black Lives Matter Plaza, and they are going to be asking for the president to concede and to follow the rules and guidelines and traditions that have been a part of America since almost its founding.
Meanwhile, a court in the U.S. state of Michigan has rejected a request by supporters of President Donald Trump to block certification of Joe Biden's votes in Detroit. The court also rejected a request for appointing an audit in Detroit. The lawsuit alleged fraud and voting irregularities, such as city workers encouraging people to vote for Democrats. However, the court rejected the allegations, saying they were not backed up by details such as times and locations of occurrence. Trump's campaign and the president's Republican supporters have filed similar suits in the states of Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin to challenge the certification of the votes for Biden. The spokesman for the Iranian mission to the United Nations says the U.S. policy of pressure and sanctions against his country has failed. Ali Reza Mir Yousafi described the U.S. maximum pressure campaign as futile, saying that it will only lead to further isolation of Washington on the international stage. This comes after the U.S. State Department's special representative for Iran and Venezuela, Elliot Abrams, claimed Washington's pressure on Tehran will persist even under Democratic Joe Biden. Earlier, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said it is now time for Biden and other senior officials in the United States to change their foreign policy vis-a-vis other countries. China and the group of 77 bloc of developing countries have called for the immediate lifting of all unilateral sanctions against Iran. They also expressed support for the nuclear deal between Iran and the P5 plus one group of countries, also known as the JCPOA. They hailed the 2015 agreement as an excellent example of successful multilateralism in resolving global issues. The Group of 77, which was founded in 1964, is a coalition of 134 developing countries. The bloc is designed to promote its members' collective economic interests and create an enhanced joint negotiating capacity in the United Nations. The United Nations Special Envoy for Libya says the country's warring sides have agreed to hold parliamentary and presidential elections in December next year. The agreement was reached during UN-sponsored talks in Tunisia. This follows last month's ceasefire deal between the UN-backed Government of National Accord and forces loyal to renegade General Khalifa Haftar. For months, the oil-rich country was the scene of fighting after Haftar ordered his forces to march on the capital Tripoli to topple the country's internationally recognized government. The conflict soon turned into a proxy war fueled by foreign powers. Libya has been without a stable government since the 2011 ouster of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. A US media report says over 130 Secret Service officers have been infected with the novel coronavirus after taking part in President Donald Trump's election campaign. The outbreak in the Secret Service follows another in the White House, where the president and a number of officials tested positive for COVID-19. Trump held large rallies in the weeks leading up to the November 3rd election. The rallies drew sharp criticism for their scant mask wearing and lack of social distancing. The novel coronavirus has infected more than 10.6 million people in the United States, with over 243,000 deaths. Let's return to our story regarding Libya, where the UN Special Envoy for the country says that the country's warring sides have agreed to hold elections, both parliamentary and presidential, in December next year. And to get more reaction on that, we're joined by Pan-Africanist and peace activist Netva Freeman from Washington. Netva, you see this as a promising sign?
No. Actually, we see this as a repeat of the U.S.'s moves in Iraq after they invaded Iraq. And Libya is the same thing. They invaded Libya with the help of the NATO forces. And then what we're seeing, the special envoy we're talking about, is really a United States operative, Stephanie Williams, who has formerly worked in that region for the United States, was the charge of affairs in the Libyan U.S. embassy in Libya, and now is working under the auspices of the United Nations to participate in this dialogue, and is talking about hopeful signs. This is very similar to what we saw was the I can't remember the name of the commission that Paul Bremer. The U.S. diplomat headed over Iraq, and they oversaw where they were claiming they were bringing the forces together in Iraq, and only to be exercising their own interests, and still a very fragile peace that we can see is still not bringing about, it's not really peace, just a very temporary and fragile and precarious situation. We see the same thing in Libya.
Is this an example, Netva, of when NATO interferes militarily, what the consequences can be? You know, civil war since 2011, we've seen nothing but deadly chaos in the country.
Right. I mean, when they interfere, they always go in under some kind of guise as doing something benevolent, trying to stop some imminent threat to the people. In the case of Libya, it was Muammar Gaddafi, the dictator, so to speak, and then wanting to protect the Libyan people from them. Of course, they've done more harm in the country, and it's very arguable if you could even say anything, that because Libya actually was very prosperous under the Libyan Jamahiriya, and they tend to reduce things to an individual. But right now, you know, you see slavery, slave trafficking, all that kind of stuff. And their bombing of it, clearly, indiscriminate bombing of Libya destroyed and decimated that country. And then they also supported extremist, violent extremist elements. And then you can see one of the extremist elements that was in the side of the civil war that has been ensuing now is somebody they supported. Khalif Haftar is a CIA man. And so they do their own things, and they also try to make it seem as if they are the ones that are brokering peace and saving lives.
Right. And just finally, very quickly, some critics have said that the goal of the bombing campaign was to divide Libya. Is this something that you would go along with?
You mean the bombing 2011?
2011, yeah, or by NATO.
Yeah, right. It was to divide Libya, but it was also to pretty much to destroy the government there and the socialist project that it had going on, where people had free health care, free education, had a guaranteed income. The oil revenues of the country were being used not only to support Libya, but to help the whole continent of Africa to prosper. They were talking about giving a solidified, unified currency that would not have them to depend on the U.S. dollar or the euro. They were talking about a telecommunications grid, not talking about, actually funding and trying to build telecommunications so they wouldn't have to rely on Europe for their internal communication to the continent. So it had to destroy those things. That was what the bombing of Libya was about. It was not about anything about saving lives or anything. And now, with this very civil war, they have to, if there's a peace, they have to go in there, create some level of stability to protect their interests, like the Hess Corporation, those oil interests that they have there. But at the same time, they can't have the type of stability that would lead to the masses of the people, the regular Libyans, coming together and being able to exercise self-determination, which is the only thing that will really help the people. Once people get together like that, then they're going to want to determine what happens to the resources of the country and different things like that. They're going to know that the forces like the United States don't have any good, and even using the United Nations to exercise their interest in the region.
Interesting stuff, Netfa. Thank you very much indeed. Netfa Freeman, the Pan-Africanist and peace activist, joining us out of Washington, D.C. Now moving on, several European countries have set new records in daily coronavirus infections as the continent is grappling with the second wave of the pandemic. Italy registered record high of nearly 41,000 new cases, raising its total count to over 1.1 million. Germany reported over 23,000 new cases, its highest daily tally since the outbreak of the virus there. The country has so far confirmed over 751,000 infections. The German government says it is not possible to ease COVID-19 restrictions that were imposed on November the 2nd amid the spike in infections. Russia also registered its highest daily caseload with nearly 22,000 infections. That brings the country's total cases to more than 1.8 million. Ukraine and Austria's new cases also reached record highs. Britain reported over 27,000 new cases, its second highest daily figure. That brings it into our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Major powers, including allies, criticized the United States for its human rights record during a United Nations review, citing the use of death penalty, police violence against African Americans, and the separation of migrant children from their families. Activists also said on Monday, 9th of November, that the Human Rights Council's examination of the United States, the first since May of 2015, amounted to an indictment of the Trump administration's wrong policies and called for President-elect Joe Biden to usher in reforms. Dozens of delegations took the floor at the half-day session to voice concerns and make recommendations. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by staff writers of Press TV's website and the Reuters news agency under the heading U.S. Faces Rebuke at UN from Iran, Other Countries for Human Rights Record. Please stay with us to hear more. The Islamic Republic of Iran, along with several other countries, has drawn the world body's attention to the long history of human rights violations in the United States of America, urging Washington and the United Nations Human Rights Council to abandon such abuses and work instead to compensate for them. Sayed Mohammad Sadatinejad, who is in charge of the human rights issues at the Iranian diplomatic mission to the United Nations in Geneva, made the remarks on Monday, 9th of November, during the Human Rights Council's 36th session of Universal Periodic Review that examined the human rights situation in the United States. Sadatinejad set forth 9 recommendations for the U.S. delegation, which was led by the U.S. Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labor Assistant Secretary Robert Destro, Ambassador in Geneva Andrew Bramberg, and Acting Legal Advisor Marek String. Sadatinejad said America should end its arbitrary and systematic killings using drones and bring to justice those who assassinated 5 Iranian citizens, including top anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq on 3rd of January this year. Lieutenant General Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, and 4 other Iranians were martyred in a U.S. drone strike ordered by President Donald Trump upon their arrival in Baghdad International Airport on 3rd of January this year. The Iranian delegation had arrived in Iraq at the invitation of the Iraqi government. The attack also killed Abu Mahdi al-Muhandes, the second in command of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, PMUs. The two commanders were highly popular because of their key role that they played in eliminating the U.S.-sponsored Daesh terrorist group in the region. Meanwhile, regarding arbitrary and systematic killings by American drones, Iran's judiciary chief pledged that Tehran will not back off from efforts to punish those who assassinated top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, and imposed sanctions on Iran, even though Donald Trump is leaving the White House with blood on his hands. Addressing a recent session of the Judiciary's Supreme Council, Sayyid Ebrahim Raisi said, "Although a terrorist that has the blood of Iran's national hero on his hands has been thrown out of the White House, the Islamic Republic will not give up the firm resolve to punish those behind the assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and the economic terrorists who have committed crimes against Iranians by imposing sanctions." The head of Iran's judiciary, Sayyid Ebrahim Raisi, added the assassination of the prominent international figure in the war on terrorism was a cruel action not only against the Iranian nation, but against all regional and all Muslim countries. He said an example of such cruelty was a recent terrorist attack that Daesh terrorists launched at the University of Kabul in Afghanistan. The head of Iran's judiciary further explained that the ignorant terrorists that attacked the university in Kabul and martyred innocent Afghan students have been created by U.S. Democrats and employed by the Republicans. Elsewhere in his remarks, the Iranian diplomat Sayed Mohammad Saladinejad called on U.S. to take necessary legal and judicial measures towards ending systematic racism against minorities in the U.S., including African Americans. He also urged an end to the unilateral U.S. sanctions against other nations, which have led to serious human rights breaches. He added the U.S. should also cooperate with the United Nations Special Rapporteur on negative effects of its coercive actions. Saladinejad further said Washington should halt the arbitrary detention of Iranians on fake charges of violating U.S. sanctions. He said the United States must end its complicity in the crimes committed by Saudi Arabia and the Israeli regime against the Yemeni people and the Palestinians, respectively, and stop selling weapons to both of those regimes. Additionally, he recommended Washington to cooperate with the International Criminal Court, the ICC, to investigate war crimes committed by U.S. military forces in Afghanistan. The top Iranian diplomat concluded the U.S. should also end the practice of separating migrant children from their parents and putting them in cages. Besides the Islamic Republic of Iran, other countries such as Syria, Venezuela, Russia, China criticized Washington's human rights record. Counselor Khola Youssef of Syria said the United States should end its executive order imposing sanctions on Syria, halting occupation of her country, hold its military personnel to account for the war crimes they have committed in Syria, and end support for various terrorist groups in the country. Also, China's representative at the United Nations Human Rights Council, Jiang Duan, cited 9 points of concern regarding the United States, among them systematic racism, politicization of the coronavirus pandemic, and proliferation of guns and military interventions abroad in other countries. The Chinese representative, Jiang Duan, said, "Stop interfering for political reasons in other countries' internal affairs under the pretext of human rights. Washington's own allies, including Austria and Netherlands and Germany, also called on U.S. to ratify various treaties aimed at guaranteeing human rights and expressed concern about racial inequalities and gun violence in the United States, among other things." According to a Reuters news agency report, activists also said on Monday, 9th of November, that the Human Rights Council's examination of the United States, the first since May of 2015, amounted to an indictment of the Trump administration's misguided policies, and called on President-elect Joe Biden to usher in reforms. Jamil Dakwa, director of the Human Rights Program at the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, told the news briefing, "What we saw today was unsurprising condemnation by many countries around the world of the United States' human rights record." Jamil Dakwa said, "We've heard country after country calling and urging the United States to take serious action to address structural racism and police violence in the U.S. The Trump administration, which quit the Geneva Forum in June of 2018, accusing it of anti-Israel bias, defended America's policies. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Robert Destro told the UN Human Rights Council, "Our presence in this process demonstrates our nation's commitment to human rights." The case of George Floyd, an African-American man who died in May of this year after a white police officer knelt on his neck for nearly 9 minutes, ignited massive protests across the United States and indeed throughout the world, putting the country's human rights record in sharp focus. Alexander Mulgrew, U.S. Deputy Assistant Attorney General, said authorities in Minneapolis, Minnesota had filed second-degree murder and manslaughter charges in George Floyd's death. Mulgrew said A number of member states raised concerns about discrimination and excessive use of force by police officers. Where there is misconduct by police officers or law enforcement agencies, state and federal law should provide remedies. Cuba and Venezuela also said the United States must provide equal access to health care during the COVID-19 pandemic. France called on the United States to halt executions at the federal level, to close down the Guantanamo Bay detention facility, and guarantee women and girls access to their rights and sexual and reproductive health. Britain called on the United States to ensure access to comprehensive sexual and reproductive health services. Joshua Cooper of the U.S. Human Rights Network, a national network of campaigners, said more than a dozen countries voiced concern at the U.S. position on family planning. Moreover, there is concern about the state of U.S. prisons. The number of U.S. prison inmates dying in the country's more than 500 top jails has climbed by more than 8% since the last official figure was released back in 2016. According to an investigative report published recently by Reuters news agency, the U.S. prison death rate surged overall in the first 3 years of the Trump administration to its highest point in the 12-year period of 2008 to 2019, after leveling off in 2016. At least two-thirds of the deceased inmates identified in the report between 2008 and 2019, that is, a total of 4,998 individuals, were still awaiting their day in court and presumed innocent when they lost their lives in jail, whilst never convicted of the charges on which they were being held. Using more than 1,500 public record requests, Reuters news agency surveyed 523 prison work for 12 years of inmate death records. All U.S. jails with 750 or more inmates, as well as the 10 largest prisons in the United States. In most states across the country, which has the world's largest prison population, the resulting database represents the largest accounting of prison deaths outside the U.S. federal government. It details more than 7,500 inmate deaths in a number of jails that account for three-fifths of total U.S. prison population. According to the report, the death rate in the 523 jails soared 35% over the decade ending last year, fueled by illness, increasing number of suicides and overdoses from drugs and alcohol abuse in prison compounds that get little oversight and sometimes provide inadequate medical and mental health services to the inmates. The report further revealed that more than 2,000 inmates took their own lives, including nearly 1,500 that were still awaiting a trial or indictment. An increasing number, more than 1 in 10 last year, died from dire consequences of taking drugs and alcohol in prison. About 300 others lost their lives after languishing behind bars without even being convicted of an offense for a year or more. The data further demonstrates that while officials claim the suicide rate in U.S. prisons declined over the past 3 years due to the enforcement of suicide awareness and response initiatives, the death rate from drug and alcohol abuse and overdoses surged by nearly 72% amid the country's opioid epidemic. The U.S. Justice Department's Bureau of Justice Statistics, BJS, has collected inmate mortality data for 2 decades. It issues reports with national-level data on jail deaths and some state-level numbers. But death statistics for individual jails are withheld from the public. Government officials and oversight agencies under a 1984 law limiting the release of BJS Bureau of Justice Statistics data. China has censured the United States and its Western allies for violating human rights in a joint statement on behalf of 26 countries during the recent session of the United Nations General Assembly. China's ambassador to the United Nations General Assembly, Zhang Jun, further demanded the complete and immediate removal of U.S.-led unilateral sanctions on other countries during the general debate of the U.N. General Assembly's Third Committee on Monday, 5th of October. Also pointing to the harsh impact of the coronavirus pandemic on all nations, particularly developing countries, the Chinese ambassador to the U.N., Zhang Jun, said, "We continue to witness the application of unilateral coercive measures which are contrary to the purpose and principles of the United Nations Charter and international law, multilateralism, and the basic norm of international relations." The Chinese diplomat delivered a statement on behalf of 26 countries including Angola, Antigua, Barbuda, Belarus, Burundi, Cambodia, Cameroon, China, Cuba, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Islamic Republic of Iran, Myanmar, Namibia, Laos, Nicaragua, Pakistan, Palestine, Russia, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, South Sudan, Sudan, Suriname, Syria, Venezuela and Zimbabwe. Noting that the response to and the recovery from COVID-19 required global solidarity and international cooperation, the Chinese ambassador further emphasized that unilateral coercive measures had an undeniable impact on human rights, and they impeded the full realization of social and economic development, and hindered the well-being of the population, especially women and children, in those nations that had been targeted. Insisting that the inhuman sanctions hampered access to medicines and medical technology, medical equipment and supplies, Zhang Jun said, "This is particularly relevant in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic." Senior United Nations officials and the international community have recognized the heavy and negative impact of these measures. Zhang Jun further pointed to the persisting racial discrimination and police violence in the United States, highlighting the police killing of George Floyd and also Jacob Blake in recent months. He said, "Nearly 20 years after the adoption of the Durban Declaration, instances of such brutal killings of African Americans and other vulnerable people by police officers continue to take place very regularly in the United States." The Chinese diplomat Zhang Jun stressed that such cruel treatment of minorities by law enforcement authorities serve as a reminder that chronic and deep-rooted racial discrimination and police brutality are very much alive in the United States. He said the COVID-19 mortality rate was disproportionately higher among minorities, and in particular people of African descent in some countries. Zhang Jun said the detention of refugees practiced by Western countries also constitutes a form of racial discrimination. The senior Chinese diplomat added, "We also express our deep concern over the health situation of migrants at immigration detention centers in certain countries that reflects a contemporary form of racial discrimination."
Food for thought.
Salam, and here is another thought-provoking saying for our guidance from Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, to Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Live amongst people in such a manner that if you die, they weep for you, and if you're alive, they crave for your company.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Consequences of Ignorance. Brothers and sisters, loss caused by ignorance is not merely limited to inability to make significant achievements in life. Those who act without knowledge also risk making dangerous mistakes leading to corruption and destruction. One finds cases where an ignorant person intends to do good for his child, but he leads him to misfortune. Then, you know, he intends to serve Islam, but disgraces religion. Intends to create peace among people, but aggravates disputes and hypocrisy. He generally ends up doing more harm than good. Ignorance is our enemy. Jahala and ignorance is something that destroys an individual and human society as well. It has adverse effects on a society at multiple levels. Okay? Now, this ignorance is something which is there, and we see it in the society. Look around you. How many people act based on knowledge? How many people act based on concrete evidence? Well, you would find, unfortunately, especially when it comes to those who are at some position in the society, unfortunately, many times we notice and realize that they are acting out of ignorance. If they had knowledge, if they were the subject matter experts, their decisions would have been different. So ignorance is our enemy. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing ignorance and its consequences. Imam Jawad alayhi salam said, "One who acts without knowledge and information will more often be a corrupter rather than a reformer." See, without knowledge and without holistic picture and without complete information, unfortunately, if we decide to act, we are going to bring about more calamities than good. We are going to bring about more disturbance than peace. So acting with knowledge, acting with information, adequate information, correct information, reliable information is essential. Otherwise, we're just going to damage the society. The Quran urges the mankind to think, ponder, reflect, and acquire knowledge that would bring them closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and His creation. So see how knowledge is directly concerned with our recognition and connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam commanded knowledge upon all Muslims and urged them to seek knowledge as far as they could reach and also seek it all times. See, in Islam, we have a hadith which says that acquire knowledge from cradle to grave. So it's not like that you just, you know, go after knowledge, acquire it when you're young, when you're a child, when you're a youth, when you're a teenager. But as you grow older, your journey of acquiring knowledge stops. No, brothers and sisters, ignorance is our enemy. It can creep in and crawl in any time. And the only enemy of ignorance is knowledge. This means if we are in the quest and in the search of acquiring knowledge, this is going to stop the way of ignorance to creep into our lives and societies. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I first participated in the Interfaith Symposium in its inaugural year in 2015, and this is my third time visiting with you. I'm grateful to the convener of the Interfaith Symposium, Karen Danielson, for her long-standing friendship, and over the last 4 years, I have participated in events across Chicago at the Mosque Foundation and at the Universal High School. She and her colleagues have visited my synagogue. Some of these interfaith events we shared with other speakers today. So I'm happy to be with all of you today. So my comments today are in two parts. First, I talk about my relationship as a rabbi and a Jew to Muslims and Palestinians. Second, I point to a pressing concern I have about Jewish-Christian interfaith. Now, there are rabbis whose job it is to do interfaith. They have advanced degrees in the subject. Interfaith is in their job description, it's on their business cards. I am not one of them. The reason why I am here and not them is because of the positions I have taken on Palestine in distinction to theirs. In particular, unlike some of my colleagues, I would never demand that Muslims refrain from speaking their minds and their hearts on Israel-Palestine as a prerequisite for interfaith dialogue with me. I am a rabbi. And I wholeheartedly endorse BDS, the three-part Palestinian call for justice and equality. I say yes to BDS in the first place because it is what the Palestinians have asked of us. I say yes to BDS because until Palestinians are free, neither will the Jews be free. And I'm here to tell you that along with Jewish Voice for Peace, not all Jews support the State of Israel's persecution of Palestinians, and the views I hold are held by hundreds of thousands of other Jews. Now, when you turn outward, away from your religious group, you inevitably turn your back on some of your own, or so some people will feel. And these people may act on their feelings. And as my esteemed interfaith colleagues in the earlier session know, building bridges to other faiths and ethnic or racial groups can mean burning bridges within the faith, losing friends, and even straining family relations. I know. I have experienced all of that. The walls around each of our religions are designed in part to keep them out and us in. And discovering that the best of Jewish values are also Christian and Muslim can be threatening to some people's identity. But my experience teaches me that the rewards of reaching out surpass the risk and the cost. First and foremost, there is the joy and freedom of speaking one's hopes and aspirations honestly and living in alignment with the call for justice. Secondly, for every friend I have lost in the Jewish community, I have made wonderful new friends in other communities such as here, and indeed new friends in the Jewish community. Let me tell you a little bit about my family history as it informs my interfaith work. Over a century ago, my paternal grandfather was orphaned in a white supremacist massacre against Jews in his native Ukraine. 80 years ago, my mother lost her parents when the Nazi state murdered them and 6 million other people for the crime of being born Jews. And in both cases, non-Jews were instrumental in saving their lives. My mother's life was saved through a remarkable operation, a collaboration between Jews and Quakers in my native England. Now, while I carry my grandfather and mother's experience with me, I am blessed that my own political reality is so different to what they experienced as children. After all, I am a white middle-class Jew in America. And so in previous years, I attended Mass Ikna to stand in solidarity with the religious community whose political reality is closer to that of my grandparents than my own. A community with many first-generation immigrants who are targeted by the government and others on account of their skin color, race, or religion. This year, however, is different. Yes, I am here in solidarity, but this year, I have skin in the game too, Jewish skin. You see, in the past year of 2019, something fundamental changed for me. Interfaith has become more complicated and at the same time more urgent. Interfaith is such a compelling idea in no small part because of the perception in society that religion is divisive. In response, interfaith makes the bold claim that our particular religious traditions need not drive us apart, but actually draw us closer to each other. We must scale the walls around our own religions to build bridges with others. And when we cross those bridges, we need to have honest conversation and ask open-ended questions with an open heart and truly address our concerns to bring ourselves to the conversation. Pittsburgh, Poway, Jersey City. Friends, 2019 brought the unwelcome, unprecedented phenomenon of the periodic murder of Jews in America every few months. It exposed the ugly undercurrent of anti-Semitism, not just in areas where hatred of minorities is perhaps commonplace, but also in genteel suburbia and the big cities. And as we come to the end of 2019, the good intentions and positivity of past interfaith gatherings will no longer suffice. After years of building goodwill and collaborating in so many beautiful ways, the time has come in this relationship to risk some honesty. And this is my honest talk. The conversations at Jewish Hanukkah celebrations this year turned to how safe it is to publicly identify as a Jew. A few years ago, such fears would have been deemed irrational. Not anymore. And as a Jew, I am afraid. And as a Jew, I know what it is to be in the religious majority. I have had that experience. I was an Israeli Jew for 20 years. I grew up in a country where Jewish concerns were self-evident and those of others were not well represented. I grew up in a country where the evidence of the Nakba was all around me, but there was no narrative, no awareness for the majority Jews to make moral or emotional sense of it. And so, the Palestinian past was a ghost, and the Palestinian present was irrelevant or a threat. It was only when I came here and joined the American Jewish community that I saw the fundamental injustice of the Israeli system with regard to the Palestinians. Only when I became a religious minority in a Christian majority country was I able to see Israel in perspective. Some of you who came from Muslim majority countries and are now a religious minority as American Muslims may have had a similar reassessment of how you see your home countries. So where does the interfaith community go from here? The bottom line is that even as interfaith relations are so important, I can no longer engage in them with blind trust in the goodwill of my counterparts. Back in April 2019, a religious man prayed hateful words on Good Friday. A week later, he took the life of a Jew in synagogue on a holy day as she prayed to God. The murderer said, "I learned that it was right to kill Jews in church." Not that his church or any church preached violence against Jews, far from it. But words do matter. What we say in our houses of worship at elevated moments of emotion, on sacred days and in deep moments of prayer, truly matter. Words are the stuff of religion, holy writ, scripture, liturgy, prayer, sermon, and we need to get it right. So, henceforth, I will ask my interfaith partners, when you pray, how do you speak of the Jews? And perhaps I have now come to the same place as the organizers of this wonderful interfaith symposium. Namely, not all interfaith partners are equally welcome. There have to be some basic standards for engagement. So going forward, I will ask direct questions and listen carefully to the answers. Perhaps that is what it means to be Jewish. Perhaps that is what it means to be a religious minority. Thank you.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.